Right. Chapter 5 of Providence, we're going to talk about section 3. God in his ordinary providence maketh use of means, yet is free to work without, above, and against them at his pleasure. The last time we talked about the way God's providence works with respect to secondary causality. The fact is that this section, what we're affirming is that God not only uses means, but sometimes he doesn't in his ordinary providence. Sometimes, providentially, there's more of a direct action. When he uses means, we view those events as regular occurrences. We see them as events which are explicable. We tend to be able to trace out. We think that we can explain an event if we can describe how it happened. So if we drop a ball, we have a formula to describe gravity. And we think that we know something about that because when we drop something, it falls at this rate. As a result of that, we tend to think of that as ordinary. We tend to think of that as the everyday, commonplace thing. Those are a lot of the things that we were talking about with respect to contingency, particularly of moral agents, things that fall out through secondary causality tend, to us at least, to look more explicable. When God works without means or above means or against means, those things appear to us as miracles. So I think it's really better. I know we talk about miracles and we talk about nature, the law of nature, and there are people with this idea that miracles are a violation of the law of nature. That's because they deified nature. It is perhaps most helpful, I think, if we understand that when God is using means, those things occur with a sense of regularity by reason of God's covenant. For example, God says as long as the earth remains, seed time and harvest, you know, the seasons, spring, summer, fall, winter, they're going to remain. There's going to be an explicable, predictable occurrence. You know, we see regularity each day the sun comes up. We don't really tend to think about that a lot because it happens all the time. And yet, the point of view of this section on God's providence really should, I think, be, among other things, to make you stop and realize that the difference between those regular occurrences and what we would call a miracle really has to do with something being covenant regularities versus covenant irregularities. That the same God is behind them both, that he is directly involved in the order of both, in the ordering of both kinds of events, which are some of the things we're going to talk about. We need to discuss exactly, and we'll look at some of the differences between these ordinary versus what we would call extraordinary occurrences. But behind them all really is this doctrine of providence that we've been talking about. So it's a mistake for people to think that one thing is harder than another. It is just as miraculous, if you will, if you consider the interjection of divine power on behalf of the people of God or on behalf of his creation. It's just as miraculous that the sun comes up every day as it is, as we'll see in a few minutes in the book of Joshua, that the sun stands still for a period of time. With respect to the power of the Creator, there's no difference. The only difference is in our expectation. When God uses means, we perceive, and in that perception, both of secondary causality and in the use of the means themselves, we perceive in all of that and in that perception, we find an ability to predict. It becomes predictable. So our perception turns into predictability. In our predictability, the ability that we have to predict something, that makes it seem normal to us. Which is why when something is out of the ordinary, particularly when it is viewed by us as being something positive, we tend to say things like, that was a miracle. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. We're going to develop that a little bit more when we talk about God working without, above, or against means. Just because he's doing that does not mean that that it is any less within the compass of his power. It really is not extraordinary from the point of view of the divine or from the point of view of providence. It seems extraordinary to us because it's not predictable. In fact, sometimes it cuts against what we would view as predictable or we would view as ordinary. So we'll look at examples of that. But it's really a mistake, I think, and I really think this is why people get so hung up about this idea that they want to see a miracle. If they're going to believe in God, they want to see a miracle. Well, if you're talking about the interjection of divine power and providence, you see them all the time. If you're talking about something extraordinary rather than ordinary, you need to remember that that's just a matter of your perception. Now, it's true that when God works in a way that we perceive as extraordinary or miraculous, it's very true that in those things, the attention of men is caught and, in fact, it becomes focused on that. Now, that, if you're a prophet of God, that can be a very good thing. It's sort of like, you know, a red light. It makes you stop and pause for a moment in the course of life and reflect. And if there's a prophet of God present, it's a very opportune time to make a few statements on behalf of the providence that is underwriting what you just witnessed. But it doesn't change the reality that the providence is really the same we're talking about the power and the glory of it. The only thing that changes is the relation of that providence to creation and therefore the way we perceive the outworking of the providence. So, question one, does God in his ordinary providence make use of means? And the answer is yes. We want to begin with Acts 27, 31 and 44. And look as well at Isaiah 55, 10 and 11.
Acts 27, verses 31 and 44. Verse 31, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, you cannot be saved. And verse 44, and the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land.
Isaiah 55, verses 10 and 11. For as the rain cometh down, and the snow from heaven, and returneth not, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower, and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it.
Such acts of providence which utilize ordinary means we call common. So, for example, when Paul says, except you abide in the ship, you shall in no wise be saved, we don't tend to view it miraculous that people survive when they stay in the ship. When things happen and the ship gets blown apart, it's smashed on the rocks, and everyone makes it to land by holding on to a piece of it here or there, we tend to think of that more along the lines of miraculous, but that really isn't quite it either. If we really stop and think about it, that's not really a miracle. It's not a miracle in the sense that we can't figure out how it was done. You know, that we didn't see a predictability. If you're holding onto a piece of wood, it's keeping you afloat. That is explicable from our point of view. And it's predictable. If you are holding onto a piece of wood and the waves are roaring around you, you're being tossed and turned. But if you manage to hold on to that piece of wood, the idea that you're going to experience buoyancy and make it to shore, that really, when you start to peel it apart, that doesn't seem quite so miraculous, which is why when people start talking to unbelievers about events like that and say, what was a miracle, this or that happened, in their minds, it's not a very convincing kind of miracle. You know, they might view it as a happy circumstance that everyone survived. But miracle, that's not so much. The fact is, when we can assign reason, we don't view it quite the same. And yet, in both of these cases, whether we're talking about the case in Acts or the case of the Word of God going forth, there's a sense in which they're ordinary, in that God is using means. There's also a sense in which it is extraordinary when you consider that God doesn't really need to use means. That's happening for our benefit, not for the benefit of the Creator. He's not bound to that. And occasionally we see glimpses of Him not being bound to that, which we will talk about again in a moment. All right. Thus, then, those things of nature whereby God effects His plan fall under this doctrine of providence. For example, when God's people were in the desert, He stirred up a south wind, which brought an abundance of birds. Exodus 16:13 and Numbers 11:31.
Exodus 16:13. And it came to pass that even the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host.
Numbers 11:31. And there went forth a wind from the Lord, and brought quails from the sea, and let them fall by the camp, as it were as a day's journey on this side, and as it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth.
That might be the kind of thing that we would look at as miraculous, but the Bible's telling us God uses means in that case. Probably not at the highest level miracle. The convergence, the timing, well, that's all designed to call attention, and the timing of it, that is getting closer to the idea of miracle. Because there's nothing inherent in the nature of the creation that would necessarily say, oh, we've got a bunch of hungry people over here, and now we've got this wind bringing a bunch of birds in just when they need to eat. That is moving more in that category of the latter kinds of events that we're going to talk about in terms of timing. But in terms of the event itself, clearly God is using means here. There's an ordinary providence, although, as I say, the timing, you might want to plead a little bit more. The same when the Lord would have Jonah cast into the sea, stirs up a whirlwind. Jonah 1:4.
Jonah 1:4, but the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was likely broken.
Okay. From these examples, we may infer that no wind ever arises but by express command of the Almighty. Otherwise, it wouldn't be true that he makes the winds his messengers, and so on, as we see, for example, in Psalm 104, 3 and 4.
Psalm 104, verses 3 and 4. Who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariots, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who maketh his angels spirits, his ministers of flaming fire.
God makes the winds his messengers. And so when I say it's the same power behind it all, it's the same providence behind it all, that's what we're talking about. But sometimes providence uses means. And when providence uses means, to us it seems more explicable, more predictable. It seems to us that we can, sometimes at least, that we can get around providence a little bit. You know, when it seems to be that providence is falling out in this predictable way, that, you know, the law of gravity or any number of laws that we think are fixed in nature regarding the properties of electricity or the way a combustion engine works, anything like that. Those kinds of things, we feel like they're more in our power to modify, to control. Again, this is why, although God uses means providentially and ordinarily, there are times that we'll see when God doesn't. And it really does get our attention, because it calls attention to the fact that things really are that far outside of our control. And we like to think that they are. And the use of means and ordinary way of things happening, that very often fools us into thinking we can control a lot more than is really within our power. Nonetheless, God's use of means, we're told again and again, still demands, if you will, an exertion of his power. Not that there's an expenditure of energy on the part of the divine being. He's not being wearied by this. It's just a matter of him speaking the word and it's done. Nonetheless, these means themselves are dependent upon that same word. And so they're dependent and upon the same power, divine power. So when providence is made up of the use of these means, there's still the same divine power that we're going to have to talk about when we talk about God working without, above, and against means. Winds are his messengers. Right? We might also look at the power of procreation, which is, quote-unquote, naturally implanted in man. And yet God would have it accounted to his special favor that he leaves some in barrenness, but graces others with offspring. We see this if we look at Psalm 113:9 and 127:3.
Psalms 113:9, "Who maketh a barren woman to keep house, and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise ye the Lord." Psalm 127, verse 3. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward.
And that's the reason why Jacob says to his wife in Genesis 30, verse 2, am I God that I can give you children?
Genesis 30, verse 2. Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, am I in God's stead who hath withheld thee the fruit of the womb?
Yeah, can I give you children? No, I'm not. I'm not instead of God. What are these things telling us? Well, we tend to think of this power of procreation as something inherent. And yet, like so many other things, you know, there are means involved, and we think, therefore, that we can predict, that we can project, that we can, in fact, make these means subject to our control. When we attempt to do that, what we're really doing is we're trying to thwart the providence of God. We're trying to interfere with the providence of God. We're not being subject to his commands or his desire for us that we acquiesce in his providence. The fact is this, that in this matter where a lot of people have thought to take control, I'm aware of a number of cases where they thought they had everything in control and lo and behold they have children, and other cases where they stopped taking preventative measures and they're never able to have children. So this works all different ways. It's not left up to us. But the reason we're confused about this, the reason we think that we have more control here than we do, is this. We feel like we have a handle on this. We think we understand the means. Therefore, we think we can predict. We think that we can, in fact, explain. We think we know way more than we do, and yet it's the same power of God behind this. And it's dependent upon the blessing of God. You know, we see this in so many areas of our lives where we confuse our acquaintance with ordinary means with this idea that these ordinary means are somehow detached from or apart from the providence of God. And that's simply not true. This is difficult from the point of view of the divinity. It's as difficult to push that ball down when you let go of it with your hand as it is to make that ball float in the air when you let go of it with your hand. In other words, there's no difference in terms of the providence of God, other than this. He has appointed certain means that have imposed a sense of regularity. But that's for our comfort. That's for our help. It really has no bearing at all on the power of God or the ability of God to predict or know something. God's not doing it so he can predict it. You know, I know if I throw a ball this way, it's going to bounce this trajectory and so on, because I know mathematics really well. That's not the case at all. The fact that it responds to and bounces according to a mathematical trajectory, that's for our comfort. That's for our use. And so when God is using means providentially, he's doing that for our comfort and our use, so that we have a sense of being tied to this creation. And we are covenantally joined with this world. Our bodies are part of this material universe. And as a result of our sin, this entire creation groans and travails. So we're intimately tied, and God's use of means, providentially, when he uses means, it's a continual reminder to us that there is this very, very close-knit tie that we have with the creation. We are created ourselves. Right? What could be more common or natural but to seek nourishment in our daily meat? And yet, the Spirit expressly states that man does not live by bread alone. Deuteronomy 8:3 and Matthew 4:4.
Deuteronomy 8:3. And he humbled thee, and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live.
Matthew 4:4. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God.
We may think that there is this inextricable connection between eating and being nourished. But that's not true. If God doesn't bless our food to us, if he breaks the staff of bread, that is, if he takes away the support offered by this bread, it's not going to avail us. It doesn't matter how much of it we eat. On the other hand, he has demonstrated that he has sustained men for extremely long periods of time without water, without food, and so on. You know, things which at least seem to be, if not without means, sort of above means. It's not, in fact, the plenty itself which nourishes a man, but it's God's secret blessing. Hosea 2:21-22.
Hosea 2:21-22. And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. And the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel.
If God blesses the staff of the bread, then it'll nourish. But if he takes away the blessing, it doesn't matter. You're not going to be nourished by it. This happens. We see this in people. You know, very often people die in these situations. They're feeding them, and they still gain no nourishment or sustenance from it. It's of no avail. Why? Well, we simply don't know. You know, we keep pushing off our diagnosis, and we try to assign this or that reason. But ultimately, the Bible tells us the reason is God isn't blessing it to that person. He's not blessing it so that they can be sustained by it. They're not going to find strength by it. And yet it seems like one of the most natural, common things. The fact that it needs the blessing of God, the fact that there is this disconnect on occasion, those are all indications, or should be to us, that although we perceive it as ordinary, it's really the providence of God at work through means. Because there are means involved, again, we tend to think it's predictable. If you eat this much, you know, you're taking this many calories and this many vitamins and so on, this should occur or that should occur. And yet very often, as I said, we could do just that. And people are not being nourished in the way that they ought to be by that. God is using means providentially, but on occasion when there's a break in that link with the means, that's when we're reminded that it's really the working of God behind it all. There's a providence behind it all. So we need to be very, very careful. Notice that this chapter says God in his ordinary providence maketh use of means. The means are not the providence. The means are, in fact, what God is using, at least for a time and a place. And the fact that he's using that providentially, these means, as I say, that gives us a sense of comfort. That gives us a sense that we know more or understand more about how the world works than we really do. God, in his ordinary providence, makes use of means. And again, when we say ordinary providence, that's exactly what we mean. Why do we call it ordinary providence? Well, because it's using means. And it's distinguished from extraordinary providence, which is working without, above, or against means. So when there are means being used, it's the ordinary providence of God. But when God intervenes and the food doesn't sustain, or the fertility drugs don't work, or any number of other types of cases that we could talk about, that's the providence of God beginning to work in these cases above or against means. Right. In his ordinary providence, God works by means. He threatens to take away the blessing from those means when people rebel against him. If we look at Isaiah 3:1.
Isaiah 3:1. For behold, the Lord of hosts doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water.
Yeah, the stay and the staff, that is, the support. So if God takes away the support, then what are these things? What is creation? If God takes away his support, what is creation? He created out of what? Nothing. If he takes away, if he removes that stay or that support, the staff, the thing upon which it rests and its ability to be a means rests, if God removes that, there's nothing left. When men rebel, God begins to kick out from under them means. What does that mean for a society in rebellion? Well, what do means allow us to do? They allow us to predict. They allow us to take comfort. They allow us to find some sense of order in the world, right? And yet, God says if people rebel, he's going to take that away. Why is it then, you know, that we perceive the world turning into a more and more chaotic place in our society? Why is it we perceive less order? Not just socially, but even in things like the weather. Is it because of something we've done? Yes. The inability to perceive order and find comfort in the order is because we've rebelled against God. It's not because we're polluting. It's not because we're somehow going to change and break God's covenant with the world. The problem is with us because of our rebellion. We can't find comfort in it. We don't find comfort in food. We don't find a stay or sustenance in food. Food has become, for rebellious societies, another source of dismay, a place in which we find confusion rather than comfort, place in which we can't really predict, place where we find ourselves being forced to become more and more austere. Why? Because of our rebellion. As means are taken away, these things become less and less predictable. We see it all over in the very things which ought to be symbols and of comfort and signs of the ordinary. Those things are all being knocked out from under us. God works by means in his ordinary providence, as I said, and according to the general laws established by his own wisdom. We're therefore bound to use the means which he has appointed. If we neglect these, we cannot expect to obtain the end. And God has established certain means. And we're not to neglect them. But we do need to understand that apart from the blessing of God, they will be ineffectual. Because means are just that. They're means. They're not an end. Means, something that is a mean, the word mean literally means something in the middle. It's intermediary. Well, intermediary between what? The section of the confession is telling us that means are intermediary between the ordinary providence of God and ourselves. We need to avail ourselves of means when God appoints means. We need to seek a blessing in those means when God has appointed them. He's appointed them. There is some presumption that he will bless them. That much then for means. Does ordinary providence of God use means? Of course. We see it all the time. We depend upon it. You push the brake pedal on the vehicle, you depend upon means that it's going to stop. We do this in so many other ways. We depend upon those means. When we eat, we depend upon receiving nourishment. When we sleep, we depend upon gaining rest. When we labor, we depend upon gaining something from that. So the use of means is just that, and it's appointed for that end. But the second question, the second part of this, and this is the part where I think it becomes a very interesting proposition. I think this is exactly where people begin to stumble. And they're driven by a lot of cloudy thinking on these kinds of points. Is God free to work above, without, or even against these means in order to carry out his providence? And the answer is yes. We'll look at Romans 4, 19-21. Hosea 1:7 and Daniel 3:27.
Romans 4, verses 19 to 21. And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead, but he was about 100 years old, neither yet in the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he had promised, he was able also to perform.
Hosea 1, verse 7, But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen.
Daniel 3, verse 27, And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was the hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, or the smell of fire had passed on them.
All of these are referring to events that we would tend to view as miraculous. Because when God carries out his providence apart from ordinary means, that's how we view these things. They're miraculous acts. We don't see the connection between the mean and the end. So the end wasn't predictable for us. It wasn't in any sense predictable because it wasn't predictable. We don't really derive a lot of comfort from it necessarily. Now, if we believe that it was something not simply miraculous but was a good thing, we view it as good, then we derive some comfort from it. But we don't always equate, and very seldom, I think, do people think about miraculous in terms of the bad as well. Although, I think very clearly in the Bible, we could include both. You know, when fire comes down out of heaven and destroys the prophets of Baal, that's a miracle. The prophets of Baal must have acknowledged it was a miracle, but it wasn't a good thing for them from their point of view. But it's a miracle. God's working outside of ordinary means. Generally speaking, we don't see fire falling out of heaven on people walking down the street. That defines miracle, miraculous. We also say God works above ordinary means when he sets aside the limitations which nature sets. That's an interesting concept, and this is where it sort of gets a little fuzzy at times, because under one consideration, we could say, means, you know, this is an ordinary providence, there are means involved. But sometimes there are limitations on those means. And the more aware we are of the limitations on the means, when we've come to the end of that mean, when we reached its limitation, and yet the providence of God still accomplishes something that we would have expected we would need that mean. Guy survives the wings coming off his plane, and he lands the plane. You know, the limitations of nature, we probably weren't really expecting its survival. But on occasion, when something like that happens, God has worked above means in that instance. I know there are going to be a lot of people who are going to jump and try to explain how it could have happened and so on. But the fact is, most people are going to look at that and they're going to see miracle. They're going to see something miraculous. You know, you fall out of an airplane and survive. People tend to view that as miraculous. You know, when you hear about these guys who've been parachuting and the parachutes don't open, and once in a while these guys will hit and they'll survive. Most people are going to view that as miraculous. That's God working above the mean. Now, we don't ever stop and go, oh, that's a miracle when the parachute opens and they land, they're okay. But a lot of people are willing to stand back, I think, at that point and say, there's something above the ordinary that happened here for that guy to survive. I know there are people who want to argue about that, but when we talk about God working above ordinary means, we're really talking about he's working above the limitations of nature that quote-unquote nature sets. That is, the expectations that we have when we watch the way nature works. You know, we have a sense of how fast things drop. And so, you know, a guy who survives his parachute not opening, that seems to us to be above the limits of nature. You know, we expect to find a pile of dust when he hits. And yet, once in a while, these guys get up and walk away. We have cases like that through the Bible, very famous cases, the one we've already referred to, the case of Abram and Sarah. God miraculously brought about conception though it had, quote-unquote, ceased to be after the manner of women with Sarah, thereby working above means. Look again at Romans 4:19-21.
Romans 4:19-21. And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead, when he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he had promised, he was able also to perform.
Of course, when we're talking about God working above means, again, the more improbable, the more we're going to be inclined to view it as miraculous. And when, from our point of view, nature is imposed an impossibility, such as in the case of Abram and Sarah, that case is rightly viewed as miraculous. God has worked above the means. He's not limited himself as nature limited itself in that particular event. Right? Nature is, in fact, what we call nature is, in fact, our perception of the providence of God working according to means. As things begin to work outside of that, whether it's above it, against it, or without it, we tend to view that as the miraculous line. So Sarah is beyond menopause. Means that by everything that we know and understand, well, this isn't some modern understanding, people have known this for quite some time, that after a certain period of time, you have like a zero expectation of a woman becoming pregnant. That's above means. We say above means because before the exceeding of the limitation of nature, it would be fully within what we would expect. It would be without means if a kid just appeared out of thin air on a sidewalk. That's not the kind of miracle we're talking about. We're talking about above means here. Likewise, we have this working above displayed when the shadow of the sundial was set back 10 degrees to promise safety to Hezekiah in 2 Kings 20:9-11 and Isaiah 38:7.
2 Kings 20:9-11. And Isaiah said, "This son shalt thou have of the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he hath spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or go back 10 degrees? Hezekiah answered, "It is a light thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees, nay, but let the shadow return backward 10 degrees. And Isaiah the prophet crieth unto the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down in the dial of Ahaz.
Isaiah 38:7. And this shall be a sign unto thee from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he hath spoken.
What Isaiah or Hezekiah tells you, what's the big deal if it goes down 10 degrees? Let it go back 10 degrees. In other words, if it goes down 10 degrees, the perceived miracle, even if it goes down faster than we might expect, the perception of miracle there is going to be very minimal. You know, it's going to be very subjective. Because really, after all, if your timepiece just starts moving faster in the direction we expect time to move, it's possible that you just didn't quite perceive time correctly for a very short period of time. On the other hand, if it actually is going backward, now we have something that's above the limitation of nature going on. The covenantal regularities that God has given bring us to a point where we expect time to be moving only in one direction. We move from the past to the present to the future continually. And yet in this case, just for a brief period of time, it looks like time is reversed. If there's a small reversal. I'm not sure that it's just indicating that the, you know, when the shadow goes back on the sundial, that has something to say about the motion of the sun and the heavens and all of that. But there's also, I think, an idea involved here. There's a little bit of demonstration that, you know, time itself is a creation of God. And although from our point of view, we always see it this way. Remember, in the book of Revelation, God's throne is over the sea of glass. And from his perspective, all that we perceive is moving this way, one way through time, he perceives as static. It's all frozen in place. In not even a moment, in eternity. So for God to kick things back a little bit time-wise is just another demonstration that providentially he's not limited to the confines of nature. We are. You know, we can't go back in time. We can't surmount the problem of that. And even the best physicists who are working on this problem of time travel acknowledge that if it's possible, they think it's only possible to go forward in time. See, that's Hezekiah's point. That's a little thing to go forward in time. Comparatively. Going back in time. That's beyond anything that even now than we can really conceive of how it could be done. Right? That's working above nature. That seems to be miraculous, right? God is said to work without means. So we move from above means to without means. Whatever he accomplishes his purposes apart from those channels usually associated with carrying out of the actions in view. Job 34:20.
Job 34:20. In a moment shall they die, and the people shall be troubled at midnight and pass away. The mighty shall be taken away without hand.
In a moment shall they die. How? How did it happen? Well, without hand, that is, without cause. That's like saying without means. When God withdraws his presence and their breath, it vanishes away. There are no means. He's working without means. Right. For example, God promises to save his people in battle, apart from the usual weapons needed to effect victory on the battlefield. Hosea 1:7.
Okay, 1:7. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen.
If he said to somebody, hey, we're going to battle tomorrow, by the way, leave your guns home, leave all your weapons, you won't need any armor, you won't need any of this or that, that would be viewed as insanity. Why? Because most people would understand that you're seeking to attain an end without the use of means. And yet, God says, this is exactly what I'm going to do here. Without the means, without the expected means, I'm going to move you to victory. We would view it as a certain indicator that you're not only going to lose, but you're going to lose big. We would probably also view it as one of the most, if not the most, foolhardy venture in the history of warfare. And yet God accomplishes that without means. Not simply above, but without means. He promises that. But there's a striking confirmation, which is evinced in the case of Gideon's 300 soldiers who accomplished the routing of the enemy in a most unusual way in Judges 7, 19 to 25.
Judges 7, verse 19 through 25. So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came out, or came unto the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch. And they had but newly set the watch. They blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers, and held the lamps in their left hands, and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And they stood every man in his place round about the camp, and all the host ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the land. And the host of Bethshittah in Zerareth, and to the border of Abel-Meholah, unto the Tabith. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, and out of Asher, and out of Manasseh, and pursued after the Midianites. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites, and take before them the waters of Bethbara and Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together, and took the waters of Bethbara and Jordan, and they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock. Oreb and Zeeb they slew at the winepress of Zeeb, and pursued Midian, and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon on the other side of Jordan.
God, very often throughout the Old Testament, we see God working not merely above means, but without means. He's not accomplishing what we would expect. Why? Well, to demonstrate again that he's not limited to the power of man or to the power of the creature. In fact, there is no inherent power in the creature. Remember, our doctrine of creation. God is, in fact, the only independent being. All of creation is dependent. All of creation is, in fact, subject to the governing of the Almighty Power. And apart from that, there's nothing there. So, of course, throughout the Bible, there's a demonstration of this fact. When the providence of God is not only working above, but without means. Right? To this, in all of these accounts, we can see the miraculous birth of Jesus, which is said to occur not merely above means, but without means. Look at Luke 1, 34 and 35.
Luke 1, verses 34 and 35. Then said Mary unto the angel, how shall this be, seeing I know not a man? And the angel answered and said unto her, the Holy Ghost shall come upon thee, and the power of the highest shall overshadow thee. Therefore also that holy thing which shall be born of thee shall be called the Son of God.
The virgin birth is a doctrine that is rooted in this truth, that God is able to bring about whatever he designs to accomplish in his providence without means. Not simply above them, but without them. You know, the fact is that this is very different even from Abram and Sarah. Their case is above means, but Abram is still really the father and Sarah's the mother. In the case of Jesus, there is no earthly father. That's without means. So at the center of the Christian religion is, in fact, this confession. Not only that God works, that His providence works through means, which we see emphasized in a number of places in the Apostles' Creed, but that God also works above and without means. God isn't limited. His power is not limited. Remember, again, it's no more difficult for the Almighty to work without, above, or against means than to use means. In other words, God, the means themselves, when God uses means, that's like an extra thing for God to have to do. And we feel better about that a lot of times. We feel comfortable because it's predictable, because it's the way we've come to expect. It creates an expectation. But there's actually more for God to do in that than if He were to act directly all the time. So we should be very, very careful that as we consider this, not to think that this is harder for God. It's harder for us, because we need that kind of order. We need that kind of predictability. We need some sort of expectation in order for us to act in this way or that way. All right, so not only does God work above means or without means, finally we see God can work against the ordinary means when He causes a clean contrary effect from what nature teaches us to expect. And we could appeal again back to the case of Hezekiah, but let's look at Joshua 10, 12 to 13.
Joshua 10, verses 12 and 13. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down about a whole day.
Yeah, what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that God is not locked up. Not only is He not locked up the means, but sometimes He accomplishes His purpose in a way contrary to what we would expect from the means. You know, we expect to see the sun come up and the sun to set. In fact, I think most people would be a little alarmed if the sun came up one day and didn't go down. And yet this is what God does in order to help His people win a battle. But He's working against ordinary means. That is, He's working against our expectations. He's working against what is predictable to us. Now, Joshua and the people with him, they knew this was going to happen. Imagine if you were the other guys and this happens. Now, this throws your world into absolute confusion, chaos. It's got to be a frightening thing. The people of God know that this isn't any more difficult for Him to do than for Him not to do. And He sends forth His angels to push the sun around. You know, whether we see something going down or rising, He's directing angels and directing all of His ministering spirits to accomplish His will. And Calvin and Luther thought that when we move our fingers, it's God directing angels. That we tend to attribute that to a nervous system and a central nervous system and to brain activity and so on. Theologians in the church have viewed it in terms of the providence of God. And it's no more difficult for God to direct an angel to push a ball down when it falls out of your hand than it is for him to direct the angel to hold the ball up. That's kind of what we see here. What can be more against nature than for an axe head to rise when cast into the water? And yet, this may fall out in the providence of God. 2 Kings 6:6.
2 Kings 6:6. And the man of God said, "Where fell it?" And he showed him the place. And he cut down a stick and cast it in thither, and the iron did swim.
The iron did swim. That is to say, it floated to the top. From our point of view, miracle. I don't know about you, but I've never seen iron float when cast into water. Take one of your free weight sets out and start throwing weights into the pond and see how many of them come back to the surface. It's not what we're led to expect. We expect ordinary means to work ordinarily. But God's not limited to that. And sometimes things work not just without means, but contrary to the means. You know, our expectation is that axe head, not only does it not float, but it positively sinks to the bottom. And if we ever want it back, somebody's got to get out there and go through the muck on the bottom and try to find it. Here's prophet of God, cuts down a stick. You know, if a guy throws the handle to his axe out after the axe head, you probably are figuring he intends on losing the entire axe for life. And yet, exactly the opposite happens here. And we view that, rightly so, we view that as a miracle. It's contrary to our expectation. It's working entirely at cross purposes with what we would have expected or predicted. But it proves, as so many other things in the Bible, that God's providence is not limited to means. His providence is the way he's governing. And he can govern with or without means as he sees fit. And what could be more contrary to the nature of things than for a man to walk upon the surface of water not submerged in it? And yet, it's exactly what Peter did when the Master beckoned him come in Matthew 14:29.
Matthew 14:29, and he said, "Come." And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus.
As long as he had his eyes on Jesus, what was he doing? He was walking on water. It's no more difficult in the providence of God to walk on water than to sink below. It's really only because God has appointed certain means, and by reason of those means, our ordinary experiences, not that we walk on water, but that we end up trudging through water, often getting our shoes wet, things like that. We don't find ourselves just able to walk over puddles, we're walking through them. The same if you go to the ocean, you're walking into the water, you're not walking on top of it. But the point is, it's no more difficult. It may seem odd to us, but that's because we have certain expectations. And that's normal. We should have those expectations. They are regularities, covenantal regularities God has set in the creation itself. If they weren't there, we wouldn't notice when these kinds of things happen. You know, it would be equally possible Peter starts out, he walks on the water, then he's under the water, then he's on the water, then he's under the water. You know, sometimes we throw an axe head in the water, it floats. Sometimes it sinks. We don't know. These things exist. The means exist for our benefit, and they present a certain amount of regularity to us. That's for us. God isn't the one sitting back wondering what's going on. We're the ones who start to think that when we see things providentially occur that are out of the ordinary for us. The fact is that various accounts of raising from the dead all show themselves to be accomplished against means. We want to look at John 11:39-44.
John 11:39-44. Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. Jesus saith unto her, Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, Loose him, and let him go.
Okay. And here again, in the case of Lazarus, and it's very interesting, I think, because in most cases where we have miracles in the Bible, they're preceded like this, where there's something ordinary. Jesus asked them to roll away the stone. Why? Couldn't he have just said to the stone, hey, roll away? And it would do it? Would have taken no more power. But the fact that there's something ordinary, something that occurs in the way we expect it to occur. You know, the stone is heavy. It takes maybe a few people to roll it away. All of that is setting the ground for the surprise that we are going to have when providence conducts itself in a way, in this case, against nature. Or against means. You know, our expectation until Jesus calls Lazarus forth is that we're going to roll away the stone and it's going to stink. Because he's decaying. It's been 4 days in the tomb. It's not a good thing. It's a hot climate. You know, it's going to smell. That's means. That's what we expect. We expect providence working in one way. So the setup is to enforce that. We expect providence to work in one way, and then with a word, we see providence working against the very means that we'd expected. Miracles are just that. And the more we perceive in them that they're done without means, above means, or contrary to means, the more, from our point of view, the more miraculous they appear. All right, to maintain that the laws of nature are so absolutely fixed that they can in no case be deviated from would be to exclude God from the government of the world to represent the universe as a vast machine, whose movements are regulated by certain laws which even the great architect cannot control. Mark 4:41.
Mark 4:41. And they feared exceedingly, and said one to another, what manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?
Again, the expectations of that. What is being demonstrated when Christ is doing all of that, when he's commanding the wind and the sea to be still? Those are the kinds of things where we see his divinity on display, where his divinity is very clearly in the foreground. When people deny what we tend to think of as supernatural, when they tend to exclude God from all of this, when they say, well, you know, that couldn't happen because the laws of nature not only predict but demand that this or that thing happen. They're trying to exclude God from his universe. You know, if they do believe in any kind of supernatural being, they're no better than deists. God's providence is not in any way limited to means. To the extent that God uses means providentially, remember, that's for us. That's for our benefit. God is doing it in an orderly way, in an ordinary way. A way that we can process and understand. But on occasion, things happen that we don't understand. Those are reminders that the providence of God isn't to be confined to some little box. That God isn't limited in what he does. Right, next time, we want to talk about the question of the providence of God as it is his wisdom and goodness, and we want to take up the question of evil and the sins of men. So we'll begin to talk about that. All of this is laying the groundwork for the next chapter where we'll talk about the fall of man and the entrance of sin. So, providence of God for a few more weeks, and then we'll be talking about the fall into sin.